So today we start with a presentation of key themes emerging from feedback on the FICE discussion paper. I'll give the floor to the FICE squad.
Yes, thanks Hans. Good morning everybody, FICE is back. So the board published the discussion paper last June and the comment period ended early January this year. So the purpose of the session today is really to inform the board the key themes coming out of the feedback received from the comment letter, but as well as also our outreach meetings, and also to give the board members the opportunity to ask a question if they have any questions about what is included in this paper. Many stakeholders around the world have put in significant time and effort to provide the useful feedback on our discussion paper. The detailed analysis of the letters are in progress. So we have highlighted, as we have highlighted in the red box on this slide number two, please treat this as a preview of what you would expect to see in the coming month when we bring back the detailed comment letter analysis. In filtering out the key themes, we have focused on highlighting not just the key themes or feedback itself, but also the reasons and the driver for such themes, because we think it's important to understand, and we plan to continue that in our detailed comment letter analysis. Given the objective today, we will not be asking any question at this session. In terms of the structure of today's session, is the way we structured this board paper is firstly to provide an overview of the themes coming out of the feedback about the discussion paper as a whole or the project as a whole. So that is covered in slide 5 to 10. This is then followed by feedback on the different components of the discussion paper, namely classification, presentation, and disclosure, and those are covered up to slide number 29. And finally, we have a separate section on investors' feedback or feedback from the users of financial statements, which we refer to them as investor in this pack. So if you agree, we would like to propose that we talk through some of the key points from each section and pause after each section for you to provide additional comments or ask questions, if any. So are you happy with that format? Great. So I will then start with the presentation on overall messages and the feedback on classification, and I will pass on to Lira to cover presentation and disclosure, and finally, Andrew will cover the investors' feedback. So if you turn over to slide number 5, that's really about the overall feedback about the discussion paper or the project as a whole. So across all types of stakeholders, there was a wide acknowledgement that distinguishing liabilities from equity is a very important subject in financial reporting. And many agreed that agreed with the board proposal to continue a binary distinction between them as liability and equity. And another common theme noted through the feedback was that respondents seem to perceive this discussion paper proposal as a fundamental change from IAS 32, and the reasons cited included that the discussion paper uses new terminology, which are very different from IAS 32 in their view. And another reason was some of the classification change for particular types of financial instrument, which was viewed as significant for market participants of that asset class. Also, there was a large volume of comments which related to the way the board's preferred approach was articulated. So in other words, those comments related to the clarity of articulation rather than the concerns over the underlying concepts of the board's discussion, board's proposal in the discussion paper. And we think this is a very important distinction, so we plan to continue to develop and make this distinction clear when we do the detailed comment letter analysis. And you will see some of the example of this distinction on slide number 16 when we talk about the feedback on the amount feature. The following slides sets out the feedback of different parts of the discussion paper. And as a reminder, we included a slide which summarizes what was in the discussion paper. But in the interest of time, I propose that we do not talk through those slides unless you have any specific questions. So, first of all, the discussion paper identified some of the key challenges arising from applying IS-32 today and asked the question, do respondents think standard setting is required to address such challenges? So there has been generally an agreement that standard setting is needed to address those challenges, but there were mixed views on how. So there were some who would prefer a narrow scope targeted project which will address those specific issues while not changing IS-32 too much from what it is today. And there were others who said if the board wants to have a sound principle, there needs to be a more fundamental and conceptual review. And there were a few who suggested the board consider doing both because they think there are some issues which could be addressed using a short-term targeted project, and while there are other issues which would require a bit more broader conceptual review. So, mixed bag. Another thing we wanted to highlight is our learning from some of the outreach meetings we have conducted. So when the board was developing this discussion paper, the board was aware of some diversity in the way IS-32 was being applied in practice, and those were identified in the discussion paper. But through the outreach meetings, it appeared that some of the accounting diversity were a bit more significant than the board was anticipating when developing this discussion paper. And especially some of the interpretations of the current IS-32 requirements seems to be a bit broader than the board anticipated. And one of the good example of such interpretation is how the fix-for-fix condition is applied in practice. So before I move on to feedback on different components of the discussion paper, does any board member have any comments or questions?
I guess just to echo the last point that you made, don't know whether it's common knowledge or not, but when we put this discussion paper out, I think I was not fully convinced that we really needed to do that much at the... I wasn't as convinced as others, I think, that we needed to do something in 32 in terms of changing classification so much. I always thought that maybe if we had a better articulation in the basis, if you like, that we may have a better go in terms of getting consistent application at the front of the document, because in the cases where the committee, the interpretations committee, has perhaps had preferred views but hasn't been able to finalise things because of, you know, people saying, but why is that the answer? I hoped that maybe this process could assist with that why aspect of it. But having done some of the outreach on this document, I'm now convinced we have to do something. I'm not sure what the something is. But because the application of 32 is much more diverse than what I had realised, going out talking to people and what people have started to accept is, of course, this is what the words mean. It's not what, of course, I think the words mean. And so I think we've got, you know, for me, a stronger case to do something than I had thought when we went out with the document.
Mary?
I think my... comment is largely an echo of Sue's, maybe not quite as passionate about some of that, but a similar observation. And so in terms of requests to the staff for future feedback, it may not be possible for the overview, you know, the detailed summary, but soon after, I think it would be helpful for me to get a description of the differences that we had not anticipated when we went into this project. Not every excruciating detail, every single one, but just a sense, because I think we looked at it and said, let's do limited reconsideration of the basics, because we think overall it's working quite well, and the problem comes with a relatively narrow population. And I accept the comments that I think it's important that you highlighted up front, that many people perceive this as a bigger throw it up in the air than we intended it to be. We thought we were trying to basically reorder existing requirements in a more coherent way to show how they interact for the most part. But we did that on the basis that we thought most of it was giving consistent answers in practice. And I think I'd like to look at what the examples are of the diversity beyond our expectation, so we can think about how that informs what we do as a next step.
Gary?
Thank you. Begin, first of all, Uni, I thought this was a very good set of slides that you and the team put together, and very easy, given the nature of the subject, very easy to read. But between this slide and the slide before it, if you go back to on the left-hand side, you got maybe we just work on individual instruments. The right-hand side suggests more fundamental. Right. Now, whether it's a fundamental review or it's just a better articulation of the fundamentals, if you go back to slide 10, I think we need to keep in mind there is a wide variety of financial instruments. There's a very large group of very smart people who create these things to get around barriers, whether tax, accounting, reporting, contractual, secured, or whatever. A lot of people make money creating these products. So whatever we write has to be fundamental. If you start dealing instrument by instrument, first of all, you're always 5 years behind. And by the time you get done with an instrument level review, there'll be a whole suite of new products that are out there. And so that would, as we go through, you know, your greater feedback at, you know, the next session someplace or others, I think I would ask, focus better, what do we, when they ask for a more fundamental review, be more detailed. Do they mean a better articulation of it, or really are they thinking, are they mezzanine? Are they thinking something else? But I think this is never going to get done, and we'll be doing this forever if you're dealing with kind of individual instrument type level.
I agree with Gary on this. I was in Mexico last week, where I heard some comments on the discussion paper, and then, you know, when people talk to you straight, they tend to be a little bit more blunt than when they write a comment letter, and they found it impossible is perhaps not the right word, but they found the discussion paper incredibly difficult to understand. And I think if we want to work with principles going forward, then these principles have to be understandable, so we really have to do our best to make this a little bit more understand. Well, I'm not done.
Oh, I'm sorry, but sure.
And secondly, it really worries me that there is so much variety in practice, especially I understand that also in the banking sector there is a lot of variety in practice, and the banking sector being extremely leveraged. It really matters whether an instrument is a liability or equity in economically. Yes. So I find it unacceptable that 10 years after the crisis we have this problem. So while on the one hand we have to go perhaps a little bit more fundamental, would we be able to do so expeditiously so that we can fix these problems as soon as possible? Because it's really worrying me. Gary, sorry.
Back on the fundamental review, I'm not asking for us to consider a mezzanine approach, but was there an ask for it? Because you think part of our problem is we've got a binary, it's a liability or it's an equity, and these things have got elements of both, and depending on relative market pricing, I mean, it might be a little more equity this year and a little bit more debt next year and so on. I know this is not a new issue, this has been around for 40, 50 years, the mezzanine. Is it such an awful thing that we don't have a mezzanine? Say, look, in fact, these are all the hybrids are bucketed in one place. I mean, it does sort of break the liabilities plus equity model. But again, I'm not advocating. I just think we're going to get to that question in time. It, or we're going to be something that might be 40% equity and it's a liability, you know, and or it's 60% debt and it's an equity. And the you just wonder, is there a better way? You know, with, maybe there's not, because I'm not advocating it, but you can't, I don't think, I think the question is inescapable.
Yeah, so without saying anything for or against that approach, in terms of what we've heard, while people acknowledge that there are instruments that have both the characteristics of debt and equity, there were very limited support for the mezzanine approach. So people were happy with the binary distinction using equity and liability.
And they may be. The question is, what answer do they want?
Yeah.
You know, if you want the answer to be equity and it looks like it's debt, all of a sudden the mezzanine's looking like a good alternative, you know, and vice versa. So, yeah, we agree to be binary as long as it's the binary definition I want.
Yeah.
You know? I think the short answer to that is they mainly want the answers they've got now.
Okay.
Thank you. I'd like to make questions on slide 9.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed views on how these two views. Before making any kind of a conclusion, I'd like to hear the evidence you collected, you know, previously. So you did a very nice job to collect all kind of comment letters,
mm-hmm.
and also you collected some kind of a investors' views. That's excellent. Yeah, so to make a final conclusion, that'll be the coming month, in coming months that we are going to do.
Yeah.
But based on this kind of a summary, very good summary, I'd like to feel some kind of a direction.
Mm-hmm.
What this mixed views means in a kind of a 50-50% each, or there is some kind of a more stronger tendency
mm-hmm.
on either of these two approaches or a combination of these two. So can I have some kind of feeling?
Yeah, we plan to expand a lot more on this topic, including others in the coming months when we bring back the detailed comment letter analysis. And I think the focus of this session has been to bring out the key themes and also highlight what are the reasons, the driver of those key themes, rather than focusing too much on how many have said this versus how many have said the other. But if I were to give you a really high-level feel, I think there were a bit more people, more bigger size of respondents who preferred a more targeted approach looking at the specific issues. But I wouldn't say those who also suggested a fundamental review was a small population. It wasn't. So, yeah.
But that's because it's very important, as Gary suggested, you know, if we don't have get some information or kind of tendency, then there will be a really big debate among us,
yeah.
you know, which direction we are going to do.
Yeah, sure.
Another thing is on slide 5, you said some kind of fundamental change. So the feedback says we are doing a kind of fundamental change because use of new terminologies.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, even though we used some kind of new terminologies, but I guess no big difference from the IS-32 terminology, from the terminology. Yeah, there are some, but what I'm saying is it possible for you to think whether we can replace this new terminology
mm-hmm.
perceived by our stakeholders with just the existing terminologies, you know, in IS-32 or something? I guess we can, even though we use the existing terminologies to develop this kind of some model, I guess that's possible without using the kind of maybe stakeholders are saying some amount of feature, independent, available resource. They are saying that's not familiar.
Mm.
So that's why they think, they perceive our proposal is a kind of fundamental change.
Mm.
But if we just replace those kinds of terminologies with the existing ones that are familiar to our stakeholders, then we can avoid that kind of perception. And we can focus on the contents of the model
mm-hmm.
and the benefits of the model more rigorously. That's what I'm saying. We need to some kind of a reduce or maybe a kind of a worse perception among stakeholders. That's what I'm saying. So if you can do reduce this kind of a use of new terminologies, then we can get our proposal better in better position to make our stakeholders accept. So that's the question. Is it possible to replace that kind of new term?
We will consider your suggestion for future analysis, but I think this meeting is really about what we have heard or not what we think about them. So we don't want to go too much further than summarizing and informing you of what we have heard. But we will consider that when we do the future analysis. Thank you.
Tom?
Yeah, just going back to slide 9 for a second, I think I always thought one of the big things here was that IAS 32 really doesn't have compelling principles and that we were going to try and create it. And that so when we dealt with these current problems, we would do it from a principled rather than an ad hoc basis. And I just, on the two things here, if we prioritize addressing application challenges without generating some principles, then by default, we'll do it on an ad hoc basis. So it's not just a choice of addressing current issues versus more fundamental. It's how we're going to address current issues. Mm-hmm. So I think that's my big point, and that's where I see these two little boxes as somewhat interrelated, because if we're going to do it as we claim on a principled basis, then you've got to link those two boxes.
Yeah,
I think it's possible that we might be able to do it a bit more concisely and in a more user-friendly way than we did, and I think we could have communicated better. But I would like us still to try and generate some principles that will stand us in good stead for a long time to come.
Yeah, I don't think that we need to go away and try to have another fundamental review of the underlying concepts. We just have to articulate and clarify them better. Having said that, it will also be clear that our premise that whatever we were going to do would have a limited impact, that is probably going to change, because we have perceived that the problems are bigger than we anticipated. So if we provide a solution, it will probably be more change in practice than what we have anticipated doing, but that will be necessary. Mary?
I just wanted to follow up on Chung Wu's comment about slide 9. And, Uni, I think you answered it exactly right in terms of the sense of the division between things. But just want to offer caution about how things can get summarized in slides like this, because I don't think it was everybody having the same question in mind and some saying go more fundamental and some saying go more limited. I think some people came in and said, the way we think about standard setting, you have just finished a conceptual framework. Why, from a process perspective, are you not starting with that? I mean, that wasn't everybody who was on the right-hand side, but I think it was, from the letters I've read, the main driver. It was more people thinking from a process perspective, who advocated the fundamental review. And I think a lot of the people who said, a number of those who were saying prioritize answering the practice issues, were maybe concerned that the principles we articulated were going to drive changes in classification, either in how they were applying the existing requirements in practice, or because our articulation of the underlying would explicitly change some things. So I think when you put these two things together, Chung Wu, it isn't how many thought this, how many thought that. I think we're getting people coming from quite different places who fall into one of these two buckets, and their motivation about why they were saying that varied. So we just have to be careful about oversimplifying.
My question is a basic question. I mean, this slide doesn't seem to reflect that anybody supported what we proposed, at least as an approach. I can understand that some people may have difficulties with the wording that we've used, but the basic approach of saying, We building a principal backbone on the basis of IS 32. Has that not been supported at all?
I wouldn't say nobody supported our approach, but when people commented about answered the questions, there was some who said yes, standard setting is required and didn't raise any further concerns and moved on to comment about different elements of the discussion paper, which is summarized on slide 11. So I wouldn't say that nobody supported our approach, but some have raised, these were quite common messages that came out when we were looking at that first question.
Probably a good point to let you move on to the more specifics, because I think when we get to the amount feature, that will help answer your question.
Okay.
Cool. So slide number 11 is a heat map on a general level of support on different components of the board's preliminary views expressed in the discussion paper. And the green box indicates general support, while the red indicates the opposite trend. So while this provides a snapshot of the general trend, we think it's important to understand the reasons and the drivers for respondents arriving at a particular position. So if you bear with me, I will cover the next few slides on classification and pause after covering some, highlighting some of the views. So if you click to slide number 15, that was general theme on the feedback around the classification proposal, and a lot of comments related to the amount feature and also the use of the new terminology. At the same time, many respondents agreed with the board that information about other features, so apart from timing and the amount, is best provided through a presentation and disclosure rather than a classification. So slide number 16 is about the two features that drive the classification, timing and amounts. And if you look at the timing feature, generally respondents supported the use of timing feature in classifying financial instruments. And they often cited that this, they view this as consistent with IS 32. Some of the respondents raised questions around the term liquidation, which is used explicitly when describing the timing feature. And they said some industries, such as banking sector, is subject to a specific resolution regime. And by applying that regime, the resolution will happen before liquidation. And they asked, in such situation, how does the timing feature should be applied? And amount feature generated the most significant volume of responses, and as highlighted at the beginning, some of those responses related to the conceptual concern, while the others related to the way it is articulated and the clarity and how in some of those concepts. On the conceptual side, many pointed out that the amount feature is not consistent with the conceptual framework, especially because the amount feature will classify as a liability if there is an obligation for an independent amount, even if it only arises on liquidation. So in their view, that is inconsistent with the going concern assumption. And this same aspect of including the liquidation obligation, some of the respondents highlighted that this particular aspect will result in a classification change, which we highlighted on slide number 17. And most common example of that change is perpetual instrument that contain an obligation to pay an independent amount, where the issuer of the instrument can defer that obligation as long as it like until liquidation. And we understand that many additional Tier 1 capital instruments issued by banks and other perpetual instruments issued by corporate companies include this feature. And both for the issuer and the investor of that asset class were concerned that the classification of these instruments will change from equity to liability. And in addition, there were some questions raised about financial instruments that have more than one settlement outcome that depends on an uncertain future event. So an example of this kind of instrument would be a contingent convertible bond, which could convert into own shares if the issuer company's capital position deteriorates to a certain point, which would be similar to the instrument that was subject to the Interpretations Committee discussion a few years ago. In the question, they asked the question whether these kind of contingencies should be captured in classification and or measurement of financial instruments. And lastly, there is general support for retaining the putable exception for the reasons that board highlighted in the discussion paper.
Sue? Were you planning to stop there, or were you going to keep going? Okay. Sorry, didn't want to interrupt your flow. I wasn't sure if you were doing non-derivatives and then derivatives separately. So just a couple of observations and I guess a couple of requests for the detailed analysis. On that. So in response to Francoise's question, I think based on the comment letters that I've read, my response would probably be that I don't think there was a lot of support for what we proposed. And I think a lot of it comes from this amount feature for various reasons. And I think there's a few different things going on there, but that's the area where we had the greatest challenge, I think, in terms of the feedback on the document. On the timing feature, I think probably pretty unsurprisingly, most people aren't too fussed about that because most people aren't going to argue with us that if you've got an obligation to pay cash, that feels like a liability to just about everybody, I think, and they're familiar with it from 32. I've read a lot of letters on this liquidation point, and I think we need to be careful what's behind that because I think there's probably a genuine question, which is what does liquidation mean if you've got an entity which basically has been designed never to go into liquidation, which is basically a bank in Europe, for example. Now they're designed to never go into liquidation. So does that mean that we would intend there to be a substituted concept for liquidation for that type of entity when you think about timing feature? So I think that's the genuine question. But I wonder whether because we say that if you've only got an obligation to pay cash in liquidation, so you're creating fewer liabilities if it's only in liquidation. If they can push us to give them a bigger category that's in that exclusion zone by saying you also can ignore things that happen in a resolution type scenario, banks will have fewer things classified as liabilities as a result. So I think we need to unpick a little bit behind what's behind some of those comments when we do the analysis, if we could. On the amount feature, when we bring the paper, I think you're going to need to write a lot on this to get behind what's going on, because I think there's lots of different things going on. So I think there's some people who raise this conceptual concern about liquidation. I think we need to be a bit careful with there, as there's probably plenty of people who have criticised us in the past for saying that we've got instruments that end up being classified as equity, which everybody in the market knows is a liability, priced as a liability, sold to debt investors, et cetera, et cetera. It's not representationally faithful. We're now turning around and saying you shouldn't focus on liquidation, and we somehow have to think about the interaction between those two things. I also think we need to try and unpick the people who might actually be okay with the amount feature as long as it didn't focus only on things that only happen in liquidation, and I think they're two slightly different camps. The other thing that I think we need to look at on the liquidation focus is the points that people raised about some of the measurement complexities and complications that come up. Yep. And you're going to need to hold our hands and take us through that analysis and the comment letter summary, because it's very technical and it's very complicated, and you're going to have to guide us so we understand the complexity of that, I think, in the analysis. The people who aren't just focused on liquidation are focusing then, I think, on another couple of things, and these are the things that really worry me in terms of trying to work out in my own head what our next steps are. Because I think the only conceptual way that we have to deal with the fixed-for-fixed problem we have in the standard, as in fixed-for-fixed doesn't really mean even what people are, reading into it today.
And they've written it.
Read literally. Nothing qualifies for fixed-for-fixed, even a vanilla convertible bond. So everybody's sort of done something slightly different to fixed-for-fixed. The only idea we've got to get rid of fixed-for-fixed in the document is trying to build on this type of amount feature. Mm. And everybody's puked all over the amount feature, but not many people have given us a valid alternative. And I find it hard to think how we're going to make it more principles-based unless we do something like this.
Yeah.
But the thing that worries me is that I don't know how to articulate it better than what we did in the document. because the reason we got to this very convoluted expression in the document is it's very hard not to have a circular definition. Mm. So we can say the document's too complicated and all of these things, but, you know, shone lights in my eyes and stuck pins under my fingernails. I'm not sure I could come up with a better articulation than we did off, you know, so far. So I think that is the key thing we need to try and solve in looking at the re-deliberation. So anything sensible anybody's given as an alternative would be helpful. And I think that when we look at the comment letter analysis, we need to focus on a couple of different things. One is some people just tripped over the words, so they didn't understand what we meant by independent amount, available economic resources, and how those things interchange, so we need to capture. But some people didn't really understand what the concept was that we were trying to capture. And we talked sometimes, I think, about solvency, and they said, well, it doesn't affect solvency in some cases, and so we didn't. I don't think we fully articulated what we meant. I think we also mean leveraged returns, and it's something a bit more subtle than what we articulated, and we need to get behind that. And some people didn't understand how we got from the words that we'd written down and the concept that we'd tried to articulate to the examples that we then used to describe what we meant. And the simple case of that is we talk about available economic resources, which is sort of a residual type of concept. But then the articulation we usually use to describe what sorts of instruments we think are okay or not is based on ordinary share price. People didn't understand how we got from available economic resources to ordinary share price and how that is consistent with the concept, consistent with the words, and how we make that link. And so we've got some challenges in terms of articulation, understanding, and whether we're really fully capturing what we meant. Because I think the words focusing on available economic resources was sort of shorthand for residual accounting amount and ordinary share price. But you can't directly get to either of those things based on the words that we wrote.
Absolutely. We use share price as a proxy, and we didn't explain it very well why we were going there. Can I just come one point to what you mean? It will be critical for some of the comments we have got, especially from the banking constituents and other things, from the 81, what they're talking about and what is the definition of liquidation. It's an absolutely valid point. That is an important point because it's a new era that's coming up with the restructuring and the reconstruction of the things, because technically in some jurisdictions, the bank will not be allowed to go into liquidation. So that is an absolutely valid point. We need to lift what we mean by liquidation and consider that. The other part is, which is coming from, is also basically, as Hans, you mentioned, is some of the classification changes that are coming about. And what we do need to be careful about is that we bring about what are the changes that are coming about, which were intended because of the representational faithfulness that the board desired, and what could be potentially unintended consequences. So I think that will also be important to bring out when we do the analysis, which Mary also asked, that what are the differences we are seeing that we didn't expect to see because of those words. So I think that point also needs to be brought in here, Mary.
We also need to be careful on that one, though, because based on the understanding I have in most jurisdictions, except one I can think of, whether or not we classify something as a liability or equity doesn't affect its ATR 1 status.
No. Mm. And other than one letter.
Other than one jurisdiction.
Thank you. Sue covered almost everything. I don't think I can add incremental value, but the one thing I could say is about especially going concern issue, and there is a lots of voices saying it's conflict with the going concern issues. But one thing they are missing is what we want as an information value of the financial statement. So although they have a going concern, but still, if they have the independent amount to pay out, then from the viewpoint of common share equity shareholders, then there might be the chance that you have to pay more than you invested. So that is the point of why we think it should be classified as a liability. So from the viewpoint of management, it's going concern. Therefore, it's not liability, it's equity. But from the viewpoint of shareholders of common share, I have invested to that company. So then that is the maximum risk. But if you have independent amount, which could be paid out at the liquidation, then there is a high risk that you have to pay more than you have invested. That is the information value which the shareholder needs. So the question is, how do we call it? What, equity or liability? So now we decided to call it a liability because the information value for the common shareholder is very important. So we have to explain in such a way, otherwise, you know, not many people can understand.
I'm also not so convinced by this going concern argument because, I mean, the crux about equity, why you want to know if something is liability or equity is risk absorbance when things go wrong and the company gets into trouble and stops being a going concern.
On liquidation,
I mean, it's essential.
Also, the other paradox I have in this focus on liquidation and how counterintuitive it is actually the challenge we've had with the arguments people have raised about representational faithfulness is that in the normal course, these act like debt instruments. So they're saying don't worry about liquidation, but actually we'll be getting the right classification for most of the period of time.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mary, you know the other linkages of it.
I think a brief observation about on slide 16, the amount feature. The concept of unavoidable obligation is inconsistent with practical ability to avoid. I read this as another place that people are raising or putting down a marker about the economic compulsion discussion. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, I think when you're doing a further analysis, I would group these comments there so that we deal with them once all at the same time. Because I don't, I think there are some very real challenges for us with the amount feature articulation, but I don't think we have to make it more complicated than it is by trying to bake that into this discussion. And we should just deal with it once, and not just as a mechanical thing of, you know, do we keep where we are or not, but thinking about how it relates to that guidance and the conceptual framework, but deal with it once, not twice.
Okay, continue. Okay.
Yeah. So on derivatives, similar comments around the amount feature were also made for derivative instruments. And also there were questions around the clarity of the terminology used, such as net amount of derivative and how to make an assessment whether a variable is independent variable or dependent variable. So some asked for more guidance and clarity around those terminology. And the very last bit on classification feedback is on slide number 19, and this deals with compound instruments and redemption obligation, for example, written put option on non-controlling interest. And this particular topic is inherently technically heavy, and so is the feedback. So without going into too much detail at this stage, I will highlight just a couple of points. So the discussion paper explained the accounting for the redemption obligation by drawing out the similarity between such obligation and an obligation that arises from convertible bonds. And some respondents said that they do not view those two as economically similar for some of the reasons that they highlighted. And some also questioned whether derecognizing equity while they are actually still outstanding provides useful information. And lastly, some raised questions around the Unitop account. So they agreed with the idea that consistent financial instruments with similar economic outcomes should be classified consistently. So for example, if a derivative is a standalone or embedded in another contract, if that derivative itself is the same derivative, they agreed that they should be classified consistently as proposed in the discussion paper. But at the same time, they asked when they should consider each individual financial instrument separately or when they should consider them together with another related financial instrument for classification purposes. So there were some questions on that. So.
Actually, didn't even put my card up and couldn't say so.
How did I guess that?
Just a couple of things. I think the other thing that came through in the letters on the derecognition was some of the comments about the complexity of the sort of day two accounting when we create this sort of accounting fiction, if you like. A lot of people, both for NCIs and also for own shares, commented on the sort of disconnect between the legal position, if you like, and the accounting position if we went down this approach. I think we need to be a little bit, it's true, obviously, but it's not unique. No. For example, failed sale accountant does exactly the same thing. So we do that,
derecognition is a classic example.
I'll overemphasize that. And also this point on unit of account, again, it's true, but we already have this idea of pulling things together in a very similar way in 32 today. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we made it up.
It means, just to emphasize, it means when they agree with the accounting for the NCI puts, is the gross up what they're talking about, no. That's coming from that very same logic.
Okay, so presentation and disclosure. All right. I'll start with slide 22, where we highlight the main themes coming out of the feedback on presentation of financial liabilities. The element that generated most comments on this topic is the use of OCI. And the primary concerns here were that this proposal, it is expanding the use of OCI, which some respondents consider it's not consistent with the conceptual framework, and what some perceive to be effectively creating a new class of financial liabilities measured at fair value through OCI. However, despite the concerns raised, there was no consensus on what should be the alternative presentation of changes in financial liabilities, i.e. whether to present them in profit and loss or in OCI, but with recycling. On slide 24, we discuss feedback on presentation of equity instruments. Generally, respondents were not supportive of the presentation proposal for equity instruments, especially for derivative instruments. And the primary reason is that, in their view, attribution using any of the proposed methods would be complex and costs may outweigh the benefits. And just as an illustration of this point, some respondents said that determining the fair value of all derivative equity instruments only for the purpose of attribution may somewhat be onerous. Moving to another section of the discussion paper, disclosures, on slide 25. Now, this is the area where respondents widely welcomed the proposal to the discussion paper, and many encouraged the board to pursue these proposals regardless of the direction of the overall project. Some of the challenges that they highlight for the board to consider are challenges that were already identified in the discussion paper. More specifically, when discussing priority on liquidation, respondents say it will be challenging for them to provide this information in the context of consolidated financial statements because the level of priority is usually regarded to be specific to one legal entity. On maximum dilution of ordinary shares, concern highlighted here is that this requirement may be potentially onerous for entities that are not listed and currently not in the scope of IS 33. On the proposal to disclose contractual terms and conditions, similar to what the discussion paper identifies as a challenge as to how to strike the right level of aggregation for information not to be to lead to disclosure overload, but yet to be meaningful. Still, respondents find this is a useful disclosure because it could help them understand how an entity arrived at the classification decision, as well as provide supplementary information. As an example, understanding terms and conditions of the timing and the amount of cash flows was found to be particularly useful for contingent convertible bonds that have more than one possible settlement outcome. In addition, respondents say this disclosure could help them do a better assessment of the potential distribution for equity holders in different future scenarios. Moving towards the last section of the discussion paper, slide 28 highlights the feedback on economic compulsion and interaction with law. So respondents do agree with the proposal in the discussion paper to not consider
economic compulsion or the effect of laws and regulations when classifying a financial instrument. But at the same time, they highlight practice challenges arising in these areas and encourage the board to consider providing further guidance on this interaction. A comment frequently raised when discussing interaction with law is that in many jurisdictions, the contractual terms are not sufficiently explained, and a number of terms are implied from the statute. So doing a simple distinction between what is a contractual term and what arises as a requirement from the statute may not be may be difficult to apply in practice. For instance, what actually happens on liquidation, which is necessary to apply the amount feature, may not always be a contractual term, but instead may be set out in the statute. Finally, many respondents pointed on the interaction between the proposals in the discussion paper and the existing requirements in IFRS standards. We have provided in slide 29 the more common example of these interactions, which were mentioned in the comment letter.
No comments, questions? No.
Okay, then we can move on to investor feedback.
Okay, so most of the investor feedback was received through outreach activities undertaken from July 2018 up until January 2019. And some of the meetings were with individuals, others were with user groups like CMAC or CRAF. And we consulted with a mix of equity and credit-oriented investment professionals. And we could actually see that it was clear that certain areas were of more interest to the equity analysts or to the debt analysts. We also received 5 comment letters from investors, and we considered specific investor feedback gathered through outreach by national standard setters. So let's turn now to slides 31 and 32 for an overview. So the investors that we spoke to were generally more interested in some topics than others, so namely presentation and disclosure, because these were the areas where the DP proposed the more significant changes in terms of reporting outcomes. Not all investors provided comments on every section of the DP, and here we've summarized the feedback on the sections which generated the largest volume of responses from investors. So investors generally supported the separate presentation of financial liabilities that have equity-like returns, but there were mixed views on whether these returns should be presented in OCI or within profit or loss in a separate line item, and if presented in OCI, whether or not the gains and losses should be recycled to profit or loss upon settlement of the liabilities. There was limited support for the attribution of total comprehensive income to equity instruments, and some investors acknowledged that this information was a nice to have, but not actually a necessity. Investors generally supported the disclosure proposals of the DP. Acknowledge that information is often lacking, and providing this information would increase the transparency and also help them to better understand the instrument so that they can perform their own analysis and valuations. Some investors did acknowledge that there's a trade-off between the cost of providing additional information and the benefits of making changes to IS32. Some also questioned the scope of the project and whether the presentation disclosure proposals should apply to employee share-based payments that are in the scope of IFRS 2, and for example, when considering the maximum dilution disclosures. Some investors actually said that the employee share-based compensation is often the most common source of dilution. Some investors also welcomed classification principles that could be applied consistently, and they're less concerned about a particular classification approach, and that is particularly when they make their own classifications. So without going...
Did you want to comment? Yeah. Angie, I just wanted to make a comment about one of the points on slide 32. My sense of the investor concerns about the crossover with IFRS 2 was that nobody that I heard was asking for sweeping in the classification measurement decisions that are in IFRS 2 for employee share-based payments. their concern was focused only on the disclosure aspect, not even the presentation aspect, but the disclosure aspect, that if we were doing, we were considering what information is meaningful about dilution, they wanted instruments issued in share-based payment arrangements to be included in that overall calculation of dilution. So I just wanted to confirm my understanding that when they said they weren't, they wanted things to apply to IFRS 2 transactions, they're only talking about capturing it in the disclosure section.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Because
some of the comments, limited number, but some question when we explain the attribution, whether that will include the share-based payment type instrument, but most of this comment really related to the disclosure proposal and not at all.
So nobody was suggesting that we sweep reconsideration of IFRS 2 classification and measurement into this
important,
project.
Important, but no. Yeah.
The suggestion's hard enough, I think.
Yeah.
Sure. But somebody could misunderstand that.
I just want to make sure
we knew what we were saying.
Great.
Angie?
Okay, so without going into too much detail, I will use the next 5 minutes just to highlight some key messages on the following slides. So turning to slide 34. We note that there was limited support for the attribution of total comprehensive income to equity instruments, particularly derivative instruments. So some investors were in favor, particularly the equity investors and those that were interested in the convertible bonds market. There was also some support for attribution for non-derivative equity instruments based on the requirements in IS 33. However, some investors expressed concerns about allocating the current period profit to parties that have yet to exercise their share options and don't yet have a right to the returns from the current period. Turning to slide 35, for financial liabilities with equity-like returns, investors generally supported the separate presentation in the statement of financial position and the statement of financial performance. Some preferred the presentation in OCI without recycling, as we proposed in the DP, because they don't consider income and expenses from these types of liabilities as a measure of the issuer's core operational performance. And others preferred presentation in profit or loss in a separate line item or in OCI, but with recycling for the reasons presented in the slide. Then moving on to disclosures on slide 37. There was support from the debt investors and the debt analysts for disclosing the priority of claims on liquidation, because it will help them better understand which instruments have access to the operating cash flows of the entity. Some investors did acknowledge that there are implementation challenges, as highlighted in the DP and on the slide, but some investors still expressed support because they would not need to presume the priority based on limited information. Turning to slide 38. There was general support from the equity investors and the equity analysts that disclosures on maximum dilution of ordinary shares provides more transparency and would also help investors assess how the distribution of returns among equity instruments may change in the future. Turning to slide 39, generally investors found the disclosures of terms and conditions the most important out of the proposed disclosures. And they view it as a source of information from which analysts can perform their own scenario analysis and potential lenders can perform their own valuations. However, investors generally suggested that there should still be a balance between providing information that is sufficiently granular and avoiding disclosure overload. Yes.
Okay. Nick.
thank you. And congratulations on having so many outreach or participating in so many outreach events with investors. I think that's commendable. I just want to go back to slide 31, and I think we just have to be careful about some of the inferences that we make here. And so particularly to say that investors were generally more interested in disclosure presentation, I think it's because actually much of the rest of it was beyond their reach. It goes back to the complexity and the understandability of the issue, and even within some of the comment letters, you said not all the questions were answered. I think they just couldn't put their arms around it. And to me, that is a useful litmus test in terms of however we repackage this or whatever we come back with, that there has to be a level of understandability that is, it makes it accessible to those who are using the output from this. And I think that's where, partly through our own fruition, why we majored on disclosure and presentation, because we could have a conversation there. Otherwise, we were really, it was a struggle often to engage, unless there were some very particular issues that were concerning a particular group of investors.
That's right. I think it's also us trying to prioritize presentation and disclosure when we go out and meet investors, because that's really where we need their views to drive what's really required. So, and with limited time that we are given with the investor, that's how we prioritize. But at the, quite often they also mention that for the classification, they are quite happy to make their own adjustments, and if on adjustment analysis to understand the characteristics of the instruments. If sufficient information is provided through disclosure, then that was more important to them than accounting classification. So.
Chung-Woo.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is a very interesting analysis, very good. So one just maybe interesting thing on this analysis of investor outreach. Equity analysts are 17%, and debt analysts are 31%. So I'm just, maybe you could do a kind of analysis of from the, you know, the response from this each group, equity analysts and debt analysts. We might find the more interesting ideas on the classification issue. Because, you know, you said in slide 31, general overview of the investor feedback, you said that they are not interested in the classification, they are more interested in some kind of topics of presentation disclosures. However, I think, you know, that analyst might be more interested in some kind of a classification as well as in our presentation disclosure. So what I'm saying, you know, this is my just guessing, but if you just find out that, you know, value of evidence feedback, you know, these kind of feedback from investors are not easy to get. So I'd like to utilize as much as possible of this valuable feedback from the investors. That's why I'm saying, you know, more, you know, the segregated analysis of each group is. Another thing is on this investor feedback, 5 comment letters were received. That means you excluded this comment letters from the total 126 comment letters, right?
No, that's including. So it's 126, including the 5 areas.
Part one, you analyzed all general responses.
In terms of this pack today, we have the front part is about feedback excluding investors in this. The later part is specific to the investor, but in terms of the number of letters, 126 do include 5 from investors.
Okay, Justin, thank you.
Gary, let's make this really quick, and apologies. Can we go back to slide 28? I just want to make a comment, and we moved on before I got my card up. I think it's the last point about, and I, by the way, agree, general agreement that classification should be based on the contractual rights, but I think interaction with the law is we're going to spend more time on that than we think. You know, for example, you could have a contract term that's unenforceable at law. Well, then what do you have a contract term? Example, you can also have a contract term that's inconsistent with public policy and therefore a null and void contract term. And the list could go on. You know, and there's some parts of the world, you know, the contract is very long about liquidated damages and how you remedy things. Parts of the world, there's zero language. It's 100% understood that in law or in judicial system, it is enforceable. So I think it's going to be, I don't think we can just get by so easy and just say stay on the contract, because there's a lot of stuff outside the contract that's implicitly in the contract or it negates what's in the contract. So, you know, maybe, you know, and we don't have to process this right now, actually need an education section about with it, you know, can be private with some contract lawyers. You know, how do these things really work? You know, when the contract is, you know, nulled out or silence on something. Again, maybe it doesn't have to be for all of us, maybe just the team, but I don't think we can just go right by it.
32 already talks about the substance of contractual arrangements. That picks up a bit of that, but you're right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
So the last, this was the classification summary from the investors. So some investors did comment on classification issues, and these comments are discussed. One, who invested in perpetual financial instruments with cumulative fixed returns, they were concerned about the classification changes under the DP, and that's what we've already discussed on slide 17. But they were particularly concerned about potential market disruption, because these instruments often contain accounting call options, which give the issuer the option to call the instruments at a fixed price if there is a change in accounting classification. So I was actually just going to stop there and then see if you have any other comments.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For this very good feedback. Then we go to business combinations under common control.